The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
In this episode, I'm going to run down the top 10 list of biases that we as safety professionals need to be on the lookout for when we are conducting incident or accident analysis or investigations, or we are assisting others doing so. Now, these biases are pretty common, and there are more than these 10. I just picked the top 10 because, I mean, who doesn't like a top 10 list, right? And so we will get into these biases in today's episode. So get ready.
Hey, all you safety pros. My name is Sean Rafferty, the host of the Security Pro Podcast. Get prepared to get your safety conscious minds blown by listening to this next episode from my good friend, Blaine Hoffman, the host of the Safety Pro Podcast.
How about that intro from Sean? Sean Rafferty, of course, the host of the Security Pro Podcast. This guy and I, we go back. We've done a lot of work together. His work in workplace security, safety and security, personal protection. You know, you may remember he was a guest on my podcast talking about workplace violence. So go check out Sean's Security Pro Podcast. You won't be disappointed. And we're going to have Sean on again soon. So, man, I cannot thank him enough for that. For that intro, now he's like hyped it up, so I don't know what I'm going to do. But for now, I want to pause, take a moment to talk to you about Mighty Line Floor Tape. Mighty Line Tape, a great partner in safety, supporting the podcast for many years now. But look, if you have floor marking, facility marking needs, doesn't matter if it's a warehouse, a production facility, a corner store, grocery store, doesn't matter. If you have to mark your floors for aisles, lanes, any kind of physical distancing, directions of travel, any other informational signs or labels, Mighty Line Floor Tape has all you need to get started. Hit the link in the show notes and you can get a sample of their incredible floor tape just by being a Safety Pro Podcast listener. So the link is in the show notes. Again, mightylinetape.com/podcast. Be sure to support those that support us. Great partners in safety. Can't thank them enough. All right, so we're going to jump right into the top 10 biases that you need to look out for. And we're going to talk a little bit about what they are, kind of define them. You know, a lot of this stuff comes from psychology articles and posts. And so I'll try to keep it not so academic, but I will definitely tie these back to some things that we can look out for. You know, that's going to be key for us, is to make sure this is actionable. This is something that we can pick up on and not just, you know, have in the back of our mind as odd curiosity. So the first bias that we have is overconfidence. Now, Taproot nailed this one as one of their, I think they have like a top five list. So overconfidence. So yeah, that's a bias. It may not sound like, you know, a fancy psychological term, but it can be a big problem with anybody who's experienced at conducting these investigations. Because, you know, we may know more about the process. We may make some assumptions. We may skip some steps because we just think we know. You know, we may be more convinced that we're right about certain things and get to a conclusion. Now, not to be confused with confirmation bias, right, which is number two. So, and by the way, these are not in any particular order of like importance. But overconfidence is a little bit different than confirmation bias. So what may look like confirmation bias may just be overconfidence, okay? I know it's a subtle difference. So don't hate on me for, calling this out. You know how I'm not a word nerd. I don't like word nerds. So I'm not going to go, well, technically that's overconfidence. What I'm talking about here is what may be seen as confirmation bias, and I'll get into that definition in a moment, is simply overconfidence. There's a reason why we should know what the difference is, okay? being overconfident, we want to make sure that we are conscious about what we know, our level of knowledge, understanding, and experience with incident and accident investigations. We want to make sure that we start with a clean slate. We look at each and every incident as it's new and has never happened before. And we rely, the confidence should rely on our knowledge of the root cause process and methodologies. And we should go through every one of them, even if it's just a matter of exercise. We need to hit on every one of them and not skip any steps because, you know, we think we're all Columbo, right? Showing my age on that Columbo reference there. So let's talk about number two, confirmation bias. It's also called motivated reasoning. Confirmation bias is probably the one you're used to hearing, but motivated reasoning, they're in the same category, and we'll talk about that. Now, one of the most significant ways that we process information and make decisions and how we can like completely warp that is through what this motivated reasoning, right? Or this bias toward a decision that supports what we already know. And it occurs outside of awareness that anything else is going on. So this actually can happen subconsciously. And it's very important that I'm using air quotes, we gut check our, you know, confirmation, what we think we've confirmed to be true. The reason why this is dangerous in incident investigations or just practical problem solving is that, you know, once we form a view, we tend as humans, we tend to embrace information that confirms that view, right? And we will actually go as far as to ignore or even just outright reject any information that runs counter to that bias. So when we say, oh, that associate was new, and we'll get into stereotyping as well. So I know exactly what I know what probably happened. I know that this is, you know, as a matter of fact, I'll show you that I know that that's probably the case. Come here, let's go talk to this person. Let's go look at this record. Let's go look. And you'll start looking for things that do managers do this, other coworkers do this. It's, you know, it's something that's a problem in investigations. Confirmation bias, I mean, it suggests that we don't perceive circumstances objectively, right? We pick out those little pieces of information that make us feel good about our preconceived notion, right? It confirms that's confirmation bias. It confirms what we think we know. And so those assumptions kind of drive what we look at and what we choose to look at. So you've got to be on the lookout for confirmation bias or motivated reasoning. Another bias that's very common, I see this one a lot, besides confirmation bias, that's a very popular one, hindsight bias, 2020 vision, right? Hindsight or Monday morning quarterbacking, we call this. What's interesting about hindsight bias is there's some research and some theories about this. And the one that I landed on that I like, because it spoke to me and I'll share it with you, there are three levels of hindsight bias that kind of stack on top of each other, you know, from basic memory processes all the way up to higher level interference and belief. And I know I'm going to try not to get academic. I'm going to bring it to my level, which I like to keep things simple and actionable. How can we actually use this? Well, the first level of hindsight bias, you know, memory distortion, it involves just not remembering an earlier opinion or judgment like, hey, I knew it would happen or I said it would happen. Once we have this distortion or we don't quite remember an earlier opinion or judgment, it gets warped and it leads into the second level, which is inevitability, which this centers on our belief that the event was inevitable. Oh, it had to happen. I said it was going to happen. Everybody knew it was going to happen. I remember thinking to myself, you know, last week or last month, somebody should do something about this. And therefore, it happened, right? So there's a connection of some earlier opinions or assumptions or judgments and making the connection to something that happened. That's inevitability is the second level, okay? And the third level is foreseeability. It involves the belief that we could have foreseen the event. I thought it could happen. I mean, I even said it to somebody at some point. Man, that task is crazy. I mean, somebody's going to get hurt doing that. Therefore, that's why this happened. Somebody was injured related to that task. I knew it was going to happen, right? So it was inevitable because I said it was going to happen. And the third level is foreseeability, which means, oh, we should have foreseen. We knew it was going to happen. It was inevitable. So these researchers, I was reading a couple of articles about this. They argue that certain factors fuel our tendency toward hindsight bias. They showed that we selectively recall information that confirms what we know to be true. Sound familiar? And we try to create a narrative that makes sense out of the information that we have. The difference between confirmation bias and hindsight bias is, hindsight bias is we have knowledge of the outcome. If we're in the moment performing a task, we're assuming because we know it happened, we're looking at the results. Therefore, you remember those three layers? Therefore, a reasonable person should have foreseen it because we've made that connection. But we've only made that connection because it already happened and we are privy to the outcome. So that's the hindsight part of it. The Monday morning quarterback always scores the winning touchdown. So that's the trap of those three levels. And that gets us to this. So when this narrative is easy to generate in our minds, we interpret that to mean that the outcome must have been foreseeable. And so what do you think that's going to do to an investigation? It's going to steer us towards blame and focusing on the things they should have done or could have done that would have changed the outcome. And those then will become the basis for corrective action. Like, you should have done this thing instead of that thing. You should have used this tool instead of that tool, so on and so forth. And so those, we see how we could translate those into corrective actions. The next one is stereotyping. I alluded to it earlier, but this is simple, right? I think we all understand stereotyping. You know, social stereotyping, typecasting in the entertainment industry is a good example as well. But in the workplace and with incident investigations, this is the expectation that a group or a person should have certain qualities or knowledge about something, about a task or just work in general, without having real information about them. So if you're a material handler, we make an assumption that, well, you were onboarded and you were trained. So I'm going to stereotype. I'm going to assume you know how to do this job. You should know how to do this job. And so then that becomes the basis for all the questions and the evidence that I'm going to look for in an event or investigation. So again, we're not talking about gender or racial stereotypes, right? You could stereotype a person many different ways. Somebody has an MBA, they must be smart. Somebody has 20 years in the industry, they must be experienced. I mean, we come across this a lot. Come on, safety folks. If you're probably rolling your eyes right now, what I'm about to say. How many times have we come across a tradesperson, an electrician, that's doing something clearly that violates some code or standard? I'm not going to say it's unsafe. I'm just going to use the phrase, you know, code or standard, right? And they're like, I've done it this way for 30 years. Well, just because somebody, we make this assumption, like she or he is an experienced electrician of 30 years, they must be really good at what they do. And again, the opposite is true. We also don't want to assume because of our past experiences that we more often than not find 20-year, you know, plumbers or electricians that don't do things the right way all the time. They change out outlets and switches live and don't lock it out, but that we should assume everybody who's been in the industry for 20 years has flaws. So it kind of goes both ways. There's positive stereotyping and negative stereotyping. Either one cuts against what we're trying to achieve with an incident investigation. So stereotyping, check that bias, all right? Make sure that you're aware of that one. Another bias is interesting. It's called choice supportive bias. And that is when you decide something, you tend to feel more attached to your decision, even though the decision has flaws. So you may, and this gets a little subtle, but the reason why there's a difference here with confirmation bias or overconfidence and choice supportive bias, it's important. Choice supportive bias is if evidence points you in a certain direction, you uncovered something and you start pulling that thread, there may be three or four other things that are also true. We do this in society all the time. Like if this, then that. Everything's binary, okay? Direct cause and effect or linear. We'll get into this one here in a minute. We do this. So choice supportive bias is a little different than that in the context of once we do see evidence of something and we start pulling that thread, we're like a dog with a bone. We lock onto that, and that's the choice we support. Just because these other two or three types of evidence are true, they don't carry as much weight as this one that I've been digging in on. And so therefore, I'm going to put most of my resources around this and support that choice. Okay. And that it's a simple type of bias, but it's something that we want to make sure we can counter. Okay. And a good way to counter it is to actually add weight to that evidence you have confirmed, right? And you've brought it into the investigation. You've got it on the board as we've confirmed that this type of investigation or this type of evidence actually contributed to the incident in some way. Give it a ranking, give it a risk score so that you can then make an informed decision as to how much weight and energy and effort the organization should put into correcting that. They all got to be corrected. But maybe you don't go out and, you know, hire a bunch of consultants and everything for one contributing factor that can be done internally with a small team versus a more systemic, a much bigger problem you've uncovered that you're going to need more help with in the organization. So choice supportive bias, the way you could check that is to give everything a risk score. And that way you don't feel like you're just leaning into one because of your feeling. You feel more attached to that because it was something you found, right? And you're going to fight for that one. There's also something called the bandwagon effect. Okay, this bias, this one's funny. If you're not sure of what to think of an investigation, you just go with what everybody else is in the room is thinking and saying. You jump on the bandwagon. So the probability of one investigator adopting a belief increases based on the number of team members who hold the same belief. So it's a type of bias. It's called bandwagon effect for that reason. You jump on that bandwagon. And so this can happen, and it's very common in teams, and I'm a big fan of cross-functional teams. One of the downsides is if you get somebody from left field, and you should, by the way, always have somebody who has no knowledge of the process or the situation on the team because they ask some of the best questions. One of the negatives is they could feel overwhelmed. Maybe they're not qualified to be on this team. Why did they ask me? You know, I'm just a laborer and they asked me to, you know, be on this incident investigation to help with something that had to do with a machine operator incident. I've never operated those machines and I don't know anything about it. So, you know, you've got to be very careful in supporting these individuals and saying, we don't have any expectation of you other than to ask questions as an outsider who knows nothing about this process. It's going to force us to explain it to somebody who has no knowledge in a different way than we would explain how to do this task or this process to somebody who has knowledge. And so it helps us with the other biases. The problem with that individual is they may feel intimidated. They may say, I'm just going to wait to see what these other two or three people say and just go with that because, you know, they're a little more experienced, right? So just keep that in mind. Blind spot bias simply means we don't accept that we could possibly be biased. And this is a good one. There's a bias for bias. We tend to notice biases in other people, but not with us. And we all fall into biases and need to be aware of it. You know, that's the key. So blind spot bias is stepping back and saying, did I succumb to any biases during this investigation? And how did I protect the process against my biases and the biases of my team members? So blind spot bias, assuming because I'm smart and I listened to this podcast episode that warned me about hindsight bias and bandwagon effect and all that stuff, because I'm aware of it, I possibly can't have been victim to it. So that's a blind spot bias, okay? Thought you were getting out of it, didn't you? Fundamental attribution error. This is one of the more popular ones, right? That managers, supervisors, even safety professionals fall victim to. A typical person and organizational characteristic is a tendency to blame someone else's mistake on the basis of character, laziness, indifference, lack of ability, instead of situational or work conditions. And a great phrase to remember is we tend to judge ourselves based on our intentions, and we judge others based on their actions, especially when they fail. And so that is what the fundamental attribution error is all about. If we're driving in the car and we're in a lane and somebody comes right up on your tail and then pulls the car to the next lane over and passes you and gets in front of you, you're like, man, what a jerk, right? When that person may have just gotten the call that their loved one was in a horrible accident and is at the emergency room. Again, what they did may have still been risky and put others' lives at risk, but remember, our first inclination is, what a jerk. So it doesn't excuse the actions, it explains them. And remember what we're about. We're about getting to explaining the actions people took, the decision-making process, so that we can then focus on those precursors, that those antecedents that actually influence behavior, okay? Not the behavior itself. So when we're in a car, we're focused on the behavior. Look what he did. What a jerk. And so that's what fundamental attribution error is, judging ourselves based on our intentions, others only on their actions, especially when they fail, like in the event of an incident or something. It's, again, textbook. It's our tendency to overemphasize dispositional or personality-based explanations for behaviors observed in others while we underemphasize the external explanations. So keep that in mind, fundamental attribution error. There's also linear causality. This bias is tricky, but I kind of alluded to it. It's this cause and effect, direct cause and effect. When I do training classes on this, I like to show a DirecTV commercial, the old DirecTV commercials they used to play that said, don't end up in a roadside ditch, get rid of cable. Because they start out with, when you have cable, you have problems with your bill. And then if you have problems with your bill, you call customer support. When you call customer support, they put you on hold. And when you're on hold, you get frustrated. And so they had this direct cause and effect, this linear causality. Of course, there's more to it than that. It's deeper. Each one of those events you have to go deep on. It's not just left to right linear. It's actually got context to it. So basically, models of linear causality propose that the effect is proportional to cause. The larger the cause, the larger the effect. Serious effects or accidents are believed to be caused by serious or big causes, major negligence or ineptitude. And instead, in nonlinear systems, according to systemic models, small causes can produce arbitrarily large effects. Right? The outputs are not necessarily proportioned to the inputs. That's what you got to consider. Some small thing that was missed could actually lead to a big outcome or event. So what we do is we sort of, with a linear causality, we're like, oh my gosh, this was a partial amputation. We're looking for like a major violation or a major event that took place. And we discount some small contributing factors. The last one is known as lack of systems view. This is oversimplifying cause, right? Systemic and emergent issues that affect organizational activity and can contribute to multiple events are neglected in the safety management initiatives or safety management systems, right? So if we don't adopt a systems view or systems thinking, and I've done past episodes on this, we seem to oversimplify cause. We don't look at that 3D causality. It's somewhat related to linear causality, but specifically, we don't look at our the depth of all of our safety management systems that are in play. And that's key. You want to make sure you account for these. Now, we've gone through all of these, right? We've gone through overconfidence, confirmation bias or motivated reasoning, hindsight bias, stereotyping, choice-supported bias, bandwagon effect, blind spot bias, fundamental attribution error, linear causality, and lack of systems view. The biggest thing that we can do is make sure we have a team approach, that we have a good cross-functional team. Start with putting together a good deep dive or learning team from the get-go, from the start, and check these biases. Have a checklist of some of these common biases and say, okay, we've uncovered this evidence, you know, let's stress test that. Let's make sure that this is valid. This was an actual contributing factor. If you seem to be over-indexing or leaning too far into human error, make sure you check that. You gut check that. You make sure you run all of the things that you need to run to stress test that assumption. So I wanted to get into it on this episode. It's a good top 10 list. What do you think? Do you have any additional biases that you've come to know and understand and look out for? Let me know what you think. Head on over to the Safety Pro Podcast community and share your comments on this episode. I will also be doing a video presentation of incident investigation event analysis for premium members. That video course will be starting soon. So biases and charts on all these definitions and examples will be included in that video training course as well. So think about becoming a member of the Safety Pro Podcast community, and I will talk to you on the next Safety Pro Podcast episode.